From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The images from Colorado of the storm and its aftermath are devastating. Houses torn apart, roads strewn with debris, families displaced. When the rain kept coming last week, it flowed into streams and rivers which swelled and raged, taking everything along its banks with it. Now the recovery has begun, and now the questions. What just happened and why? This hour On Point, the science of Colorado's flash floods. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of what happened in Colorado? Do you know the dangers of flash floods? Joining me first this hour from Denver, Colorado, is Leslie McClurg. She is a reporter for Colorado Public Radio, where she also produces the program Colorado Matters. She's been reporting from some of the hard-hit areas. Welcome to you, Leslie. Glad you're with us.
Thank you.
So take us back to last week and describe the force of that storm that hit Colorado, how unprecedented it was.
It was quite amazing. It literally felt like the sky opened, and when you'd walk outside, a bucket was pouring on you. I've never seen rain like it, and I just moved here from Seattle, so I'm used to rain, and I've honestly never seen a force like it. When I drove, it was, you know, white-knuckled at the steering wheel, and it was like driving through a snowstorm, like a whiteout. You really couldn't see. It was, I don't know if you can use the term blinding rain, and, you know, culverts filled, rivers filled. The city of Boulder looked like a giant river was flowing through the street, through the homes. It was quite unbelievable.
How much rain actually fell, Leslie?
17 inches fell so far in September. That's, you know, shattering a record that was set in 1995 of 9 inches in a month. And 12 inches fell on September 12th alone. 12 inches in one day. Absolutely unprecedented. Mm.
How many people are still unaccounted for? How many people lost their lives in this storm?
Six are confirmed dead right now. At least two more are assumed dead. 18,000 people were evacuated, but 200 people are still missing, meaning friends and family have still not heard from them.
Describe for us the damage you've seen. You talked a little bit about it, but roads flooded, houses destroyed. Talk to us a little bit about what you've witnessed.
It's been absolutely unbelievable. If you look at the hillside that is above Boulder, and I haven't been able to see either Estes Park or Lyons, but the hillside above Boulder apparently is kind of a little picture of what is even further north, which is, you know, homes that have literally slid down the side of the mountain. And then in the city of Boulder itself, you know, like I said, there was just river that had almost lifted homes off of their bases and moved them. You know, I talked to a man who was running out of his home and then turned around and literally his cabin floated by him. I talked to another man that scrambled right in the middle of downtown Boulder, scrambled to the rooftop of his two-story apartment. So he lives on the upper story of this building. And within minutes, the entire structure moved and they had to come in on a boat and evacuate him. And he thought he was fine, obviously, in a second-story apartment.
Here's sound from a press conference on Sunday. Your Colorado governor, John Hickenlooper, after taking a helicopter tour of the flood damage, he said entire roadways were simply destroyed.
In many cases, you go around a turn, and not only is the asphalt gone, but the entire roadbed, the entire substructure is gone. Many places you can see where they cut into a cliff and they build up the boulder substrate. It's all gone.
Leslie McClurg, there are real problems with the sewage system that still remain.
Oh, yeah. There are three towns, three large municipalities that are still on no flush. I talked to officials this morning that say, you know, there could be sewage in the water running through the state that's slowly moving east. Sewage is going to be a problem, and public health officials are worried that this could lead to, you know, bacteria and disease outbreak throughout the state. So, yeah, sewage is absolutely a problem. These three municipalities of Lyons, Evans, and Estes Park, those sewage systems, the lines have been completely destroyed.
There was also flooding in some areas where there was fracking going on. What are the environmental impacts of all this?
You know, inspectors and regulators really aren't sure, but there were reports this morning of two flood-damaged storage tanks that have leaked over 5,000 gallons. There has been one reported leak that was also shut down earlier this week. You know, two oil companies have shut in what they're saying the majority of their wells. Really, at this point, we don't know because a lot of the times inspectors can't actually get to the wells because the roads, you know, have been so damaged. So we're still collecting information. Definitely what are called fractivists and many environmentalists environmental organizations are putting out some pretty scary photos of wells and tanks that are floating in water. So, but we really don't know.
Is there a cost estimate yet of how much damage has actually been done, Leslie?
You know, no, not anything that's official. I've heard numbers as high as $500 million. So we're looking at a big ticket. You know, these three towns of Boulder, Estes Park, and Lyons that were hit are also huge tourist destinations. So even after the damage assessments come in, we're looking at sort of a long-term, you know, issue in terms of the economic downfall that's going to continue to hit us going forward.
And when might those hundreds, if not thousands of people, when will they may be able to return to their homes if they still have a home?
You know, it depends. Some are returning now, although yesterday I went to a mobile home park that is still cordoned off by the National Guard, saying it's much too dangerous for folks to return to their home because the water could be so contaminated. So, you know, some people can physically access their homes. For others who, you know, their homes are way up deep into these canyons, it could be months. Some officials are saying up to 6 months before folks can get back in. I talked to a woman who hiked out for 7 hours from her home. She doesn't expect to get back up into her home until next spring. Mm.
Leslie McClurg is a reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Leslie, thank you so much for your excellent reporting.
Thank you. Take care.
Leslie's with me from Denver. Joining me now, also from Denver, Colorado, is Sue Minter. She is a Vermont state representative and deputy secretary of Vermont's Agency of Transportation. In 2011, Hurricane Irene slammed Vermont, crippling the state. And Sue headed Vermont's Irene Recovery Office and is currently in Colorado, helping coordinate recovery efforts there. Sue, we're glad you're with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So share your expertise with us. What is similar to the flooding that you've seen there and what you experienced up in Vermont?
Well, being here, Jane, and hearing the stories from around the infected areas, it's like a flashback to what we had in Vermont in 2011 with Tropical Storm Irene. Like Colorado, Vermont is a mountainous state, and when 14 inches of rain come hover over a mountain and soar into our rivers, those rivers rise up and they rage and they take everything in its path. Like Colorado, Vermont had hundreds of miles of roads ripped apart, thousands of homes damaged, tens of thousands of fields flooded, farm agricultural fields. So it is very, very similar.
So when this happened in Vermont, what were your priorities and what are your recommendations now there in Colorado? Is it getting roads built again? Is it getting people shelter? What exactly? What's your list?
Well, right now I've been working closely because I am the deputy at the Agency of Transportation and helped lead the immediate response for transportation in Vermont. We've been spending the last 3 days here at the Colorado Department of Transportation helping them really focus their recovery mission. And, of course, the top priority is rebuilding the roads to reconnect communities that have been cut off. Just as we did in Vermont, they are in full force right now here. But it's also looking to the long term beyond the infrastructure repair. I had the chance to meet with Governor Hickenlooper yesterday, and once you get your infrastructure repaired, you need to focus on the long-term recovery. So at the same time, folks are on the ground working to rebuild homes or really just to get back in homes and muck out the mud and debris that is basically infiltrated into these areas.
I know FEMA played a big role in Vermont and must have a presence already in Colorado. What about the National Guard and other government agencies? Has the Guard been called up?
Yes. In fact, you know, in Vermont, we had National Guard troops from 8 different states. Here in Colorado, we met with an advanced team, and the Colorado National Guard will have 150 folks on the ground tomorrow helping rebuild roads. They expect additional assets to be deployed, so that's a tremendous help. You know, we in Vermont really feel a kinship with Colorado. It's so recent for us and so raw, and yet we also know that there's an end to this and a light at the end of the tunnel, and we want to really pay forward the kind of support we receive from people around the country, both with funds and actual support. So that's why it's been a great honor, actually, to be here. We've been meeting. I'm here with the chief engineer from Vermont Transportation Department and our chief of operations. We've been out in the field helping them to restructure their organization to meet the needs of this incident, and meeting with all kinds of staff and making good connections between our state and theirs so we can continue to support.
And what about those 200 people that are still missing? Leslie McClurg told us about there must be still an active search and rescue operation.
Absolutely. I was at the Emergency Operations Center yesterday, and they are round the clock, full on. There have been helicopter missions and volunteers searching throughout the state into areas. You know, when I first arrived 3 days ago, the number of unaccounted for was over 1,000, and now it's just a little bit under 200. So they're making a dent. They're finding people, but they are not stopping. It is all in, all systems go, and, you know, they're really in an emergency response phase. And, you know, later will come the phase of the longer-term recovery. And I'm going to be going to Boulder later today to begin to talk about that longer-term effort because, you know, 2 years later in Vermont, we're still in recovery mode. We have tremendous success in so many ways, but we know it is a long-term process. And it really is a big process to rebuilding communities. Some communities here in Colorado, like in Vermont, were thoroughly ravaged, and it will be a long-term process to get them on their feet.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the devastating flash floods that hit Colorado this week. Here's some sound. This is an interview with the Denver Post. Matt Smart, a resident of Salina, a town in the foothills above Boulder, Colorado, said he was awakened last Thursday morning as a wall of water just swept through.
When it surged, the big wave that actually rolled up about 10 feet up onto both sides, it was literally like a black, muddy, tree-filled tidal wave of water coming straight for our house. So, yeah, we went out the back door in our boxer shorts and slippers and grabbed the dogs, and here we are.
And in an interview with NBC on Tuesday, Drew Deppler, a pastor who converted his church into a shelter, described the experience of those who finally reached safety.
It's been story after story after story of people that just struggled to get here. And then when they get here, just almost that collapse of that I'm safe, that it's going to be okay, and it's not going to wash away.
We're speaking this hour with Sue Minter, Vermont State Representative and Deputy Secretary of Vermont's Agency of Transportation. In 2011, Hurricane Irene slammed into Vermont, as we know, crippling that state. Sue headed Vermont's Irene Recovery Office, and she's currently in Colorado helping coordinate recovery efforts there. Sue, from your perspective, then, what's the most important lesson from a massive weather event like this one?
Well, I think that we have to be looking to the future even as we build back and recover from what is a current disaster. And that's really been a rallying call in Vermont. Our governor, Peter Shumlin, right from the start said we are going to recover stronger than when Irene found us. You know, it's such a devastating time here in Colorado, and I feel it, and I feel for these people. It is such a relief actually to be here. I know other Vermonters want to be here as well. But what I know from our experience in Vermont is that a disaster also brings people together. And I know that, like in Vermont, this state of Colorado, its people, its communities, and its government will come together in powerful ways. That's what happened for us in Vermont. We are stronger from this disaster, and it sounds hard to think that way now. But, you know, I have confidence after spending days here at the Department of Transportation, they're going to reconnect these communities. And from what I've seen, I know leaders will emerge out of the rubble of the devastation in these communities, and they will forge a strong recovery across the state.
Sue Minter is a Vermont state representative there in Colorado helping. Sue, thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you for having me.
Joining me now from Boulder, Colorado, is Matt Kelsch. He's a hydrometeorologist at the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research. It's a consortium of universities that teach atmospheric sciences. And also from Boulder, Colorado, Martin Herling, research meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Earth System Research Laboratory there in Boulder. He is a lead editor of the newly released report explaining extreme events of 2012 from a climate perspective. Martin and Matt, welcome both.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, Jane.
Matt, let me start with you. Normally, flash floods come in the summer months, but this storm came in September. Give us some perspective here.
Yeah, that was a little bit unusual in the timing. There's a weather pattern that's known as the Southwest Monsoon, where we tend to get tropical moisture from the Gulf of Mexico and the tropical Pacific across Mexico. And that tends to peak in July and August. It's not unheard of to get some heavy rains in September, but normally September is somewhat more tranquil than the summer months.
So, Martin, you've studied extreme weather events and climate change. What extreme weather events have you looked at, and what effect did you find climate change had on the frequency and severity of those events?
Well, in 2012, in the report you mentioned, Jane, there were 18 events that were studied, and they were scattered across the world. In some cases, they were heat waves. Some cases, they were droughts. Floods were also examined. They often have unique and very local flavors to them. So it's difficult to generalize. But there are a couple of characteristics of extreme events, and I'll mention floods as one in particular, that bear mention in terms of what climate change may mean for those types of phenomena, especially going forward. And maybe the most telltale signature is that what climate change allows the atmosphere to do is hold more water vapor. The condition that led to the flood in Colorado was extremely unusual, as Matt just mentioned. Maybe double the normal water vapor was in the atmosphere in advance of the rains that fell in the urban corridor, 100% of normal. As a rough estimate, maybe 5% of that was related to the increase in water vapor that the atmosphere is now holding due to climate change. So it was a small factor. But it's something that can be quantified. And another aspect is that more of the annual rainfall, and this is being observed at quite a few stations, not all stations, but more of the annual rainfall is occurring in a few heavy events at stations. Certainly this Colorado storm is going to have all of that, because that one event moved some stations in the Front Range to all-time annual rainfall records, even after they had been in a drought for a period of time before then.
Mm. Matt, pick up on that. Talk about this water vapor and global warming theory, this notion that warmer air holds more water, which then can lead to heavier downpours.
Right. So if there's more moisture in the atmosphere, there's two things that happen. When the atmosphere is warmer, it could hold more water vapor. So it may take more to make it rain. You may have longer dry spells. But then when the conditions come together, a storm coming across or something like that, where you start tapping that moisture, there's more moisture available. And I want to point out, I know your first guest, Leslie, kind of talked about this, but when you have a place like Boulder that has as long a climate record as we do, when we set all-time records in precipitation, typically we expect we just squeak past the other record by, you know, a tenth of an inch or half an inch.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, our daily record was exceeded by more than 4 inches, and the monthly record, and we still have a chunk of the month left, we are so far exceeding by 7.5 inches for any month. So these are really impressive records.
Let's get a caller in here. Jason is in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jason. I'm glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
I just want to talk about the flood that happened just a few years ago in Nashville, and how it was something that came out of nowhere. None of us were expecting it. It just seemed like another normal day. We had some rain earlier that week, and I was actually at work. Started raining, saw the water start to rise on the roads. We're kind of in a low area, and started to see it rise over the road. Talked to our manager. I was working at a restaurant at the time, and said, "Hey, you know, this is looking kind of crazy right now. We don't know how long it's going to go on. Can we head home?" They kept us there a little bit longer, probably another hour or two. By that time, it had risen up into the parking lot, and so we ran through the water, jumped in our cars, and I drove home.
Mm.
Drove through some areas that were about up to my driver's side window. I was driving a little sedan, drive up to the driver's side window, and got through to a higher area, saw it out a few times, eventually got home. And it was just crazy how much water there was out there. And it wasn't until I got home and turned on the TV that I saw how much damage and how disastrous this event was. When I saw I believe it was a school floating down the interstate.
Right. I hear you, Jason, and I know you can really empathize with what's happening there in Colorado. Martin, are people, I actually have read a lot about and have hearing a lot of people thinking and talking about this notion of entering a new era when storms like this, when flash floods like the one Jason's talking about, like the one we've just seen in Colorado, when storms like this, you know, might occur more often. Is that true?
Well, I think the previous caller really points to an interesting comparison, because it was May in 2010. I think it was the first week of May, if I remember right. And the Tennessee floods in Nashville. The amount of rain that fell in that area was very similar to what happened here in the Boulder and the Front Range corridor of Colorado. As I remember, the totals were close to 20 inches of rain fell during the Nashville event in the area. And they called the event a thousand-year flood on the Middle Tennessee River. In Middle Tennessee. And so it's very comparable. It's the kind of numbers that we received in this storm. In Boulder, and Matt can update me on this one, but I believe we had a little over 17 inches of storm total rainfall, depending exactly when you think the storm began and ended. And it lasted for several days, as did the Tennessee flood in May. It's very different than the event, for example, that's very famous, the big Thompson Canyon flood, which was in 1976, a summertime event.
Mm-hmm.
And it dropped about, it's hard to know exactly, estimates are between 10 to 14 inches at a spot, and it fell in 6 hours.
Hmm.
Very different is a thunderstorm. Both the Nashville event and the one in Colorado this past week are very similar. They were long duration, extremely persistent, moderate to heavy rain that just continued and continued. So it tapped into a tropical air mass in both cases and just kept funneling the moisture. Are these events happening more often? Well, the weather patterns themselves are not necessarily changing in any strongly discernible way. So the weather patterns that make for floods, whether it's like Hurricane Irene, we're not seeing evidence of hurricanes increasing in their frequency
mm-hmm.
in any strongly detected manner. We're not seeing them being more intense at this point in time. But when these storms do occur now, they do tend to have a greater potential for producing heavier rain. But again, you know, we have to keep it in perspective. The weather events themselves are events that have happened through the millennia. Our weather records are kind of brief. 100 years is not a long record from which to discern a 1-in-1,000-year event.
Mm.
I think it's fair to say that many of us have not seen the most extreme event that nature can deliver without climate change in our own backyard.
Martin, you mentioned the Big Thompson Canyon flood in 1976. Matt Kelsch, I'm curious. I was reading about the city of Boulder. They actually bought up some undeveloped land in flood zones after that storm to prevent developers from building there to keep damage minimal, I guess, in future storms. Is that right?
They absolutely did that, and having spent the weekend walking through the floodplains of town, I could tell you some of the mitigation efforts the city has made here really did help. I know it's hard to believe for some people that suffered flood damages, but some of those flood mitigation measures really did help quite a bit. I also want to follow up on what Marty was saying. I developed training material for professional forecasters, including the National Weather Service, and I have used the Nashville floods and the Hurricane Irene floods and the Big Thompson as lab examples. And one thing that really strikes me with the Nashville events of 2010 and Hurricane Irene of 2011 and this current event here is that the weather patterns that led to those floods were not unusual. They weren't things that we hadn't seen before. But the amount of moisture available, the duration, and especially the geographic area that was covered by the most intense rain in all of those cases was somewhat unusual that led to these really major events, major flood events. And the other thing that we haven't mentioned is, independent of climate change influences, there's the whole human development influence, urbanization and road building, that actually does enhance the runoff, meaning the rain that doesn't go into the ground but moves quickly to the nearest stream is known as runoff. And when we have storm sewer systems and roads and parking lots and stuff, we increase the proportion of rain that's going to be runoff. In addition, in the mountain communities, when roads are built, because road levels need to be surface, road surfaces need to be flat. We can't have sloped road surfaces. On the uphill side of a roadbed, we tend to cut into the mountain, called a road cut. And on the downhill side, we might build up the road bank to keep it level. So we've artificially increased the slope, and these roads tend to be the trigger points for landslides and rock slides during big events like this. We certainly saw that in Vermont, and we definitely saw it here this past week.
So what you're saying is the terrain, the steepness of the area, and then the development meant that the water quickly found its way to streams and rivers that then quickly flooded. Is that right?
Yes, more quickly than it would have, for instance, if it was just a natural environment with a lot of forest litter and you know, deep, lush forests and so forth.
Martin, how do you see the role of development and the loss of so much forest land playing in the causation of some of these floods?
Yeah, I think this is a good point to build on from what Matt said. And I'm going to just turn it a little bit and point out that in Colorado in particular, the last, since about 1998, has been a dry period. We've had the pine bark beetle. We've had fires more than our normal share, and drought has been actually the norm rather than rains. And these antecedent dry soils, which on the one hand were good because they could soak up some, on the other hand, vegetation had been lost due to fires that occurred over the last several years, and that did not help the situation. Some of the communities that had a significant landslide issue where the sides of hills just came down and where the water just was not able to be absorbed by vegetation is linked back to the prior drought. So it is a curious and maybe an unexpected situation, but in which drought as a precursor can make flooding more likely in some areas. And that has been the plague here in the Colorado region with this current event.
So, Matt, then, this confluence of events in Colorado, their specific geography, the development issue, so many years of drought, all of these have come together. This could happen, I guess, in many places in the United States, no?
Oh, and in many of the cases I've looked at in the training I develop, we do see these confluence of events. Even in places that don't have mountains as steep as us, you still have the urbanization effects and the land development. Atlanta had massive floods in 2009 that we looked at in one of our labs. So you don't have to be a super mountainous area, but certainly the mountains and the steep terrain of Colorado's Front Range or Vermont's Green Mountains just add to that impact because the steepness allows the water to move downhill more quickly.
And so, Martin, if we divvy up the blame for the Colorado storm between global warming on one hand and these basic issues on the other, what percentage would you assign to each?
Well, you know, I'd be reckless to give you that number because I don't know what it is. But it's a good point to tease out a couple of facts. One is that the rains that came because tropical air was moved unusually far north. And in that air mass, the moisture was very high, not because of climate change, which was a small factor, but because the air mass came from far away in the tropics. And then it lingered. And also the winds with that weather pattern were in the lower part of the atmosphere, pushing the air up the mountainside. One of the interesting features, usually when it rains in Colorado, especially in September, Matt would be on top of this one with us, I think, is it tends to be chilly, and it tends to be cold outside in rains in September. This was a very warm rain. You could be outside and feel rather comfortable, something like you feel it almost in Hawaii, in an upslope in the windward sides of Hawaii. Mm. The heaviest rain that fell on the storm were not at the ridgetop level, as a winter storm might often do, where the heavy snows fall near to the highest elevation. It was in this beginning part of the terrain increase, when you move from I-25 up the urban corridor toward the mountains, the air only had to be lifted a little bit,
yep,
saturated from the tropics, and it just rained in that same area for about
that's
2 days.
That's where the toughest rain fell. Well, we're discussing the devastation of the flash floods in Colorado and what we're learning about extreme weather and recovery from that storm. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Colorado's flash floods and the science behind all those remarkable pictures and stories coming out of that devastated region. Here's some sound on Monday. ABC's Sam Champion described the volume of water in Boulder Creek expected to continue for days, running through otherwise calm streams.
We are at the foothills of the Rockies, right at the base of the foothills. So all that water that's rushing out of the mountains, all that heavy rain, rushes right through here, and it cuts right through Boulder. This creek behind me, the one you can barely hear me over, usually is so calm and placid at about 2 feet deep that kids are playing in it this time of year. This is more than 800 cubic feet of water rushing through here per minute.
And on June 25th at Georgetown University, President Obama spoke about the effects of global warming on severe weather.
Droughts and fires and floods, they go back to ancient times. But we also know that in a world that's warmer than it used to be, all weather events are affected by a warming planet.
We're talking this hour with Matt Kelsch, hydrometeorologist at the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, and also with Martin Herling, research meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Earth System Research Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado. Let's go to the phones, get some listeners in here. Carl is in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Carl. I'm glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane, and thank you for having this very important program. These extreme storms that we've been witnessing have been strongly impacted by how much the carbon fuels we burn are pumping CO2 into the atmosphere. You know, the fuels appear cheap because we haven't paid the true costs up until now. We are paying those costs in terms of dealing with these disasters. And we talk a lot about in the press about how we in America come together. We come together to help the victims, but what we really need to do is also come together to support a tax on carbon, taxed at the wellhead or wherever it's sourced, so that we can reduce the amount of CO2 we're pumping into the atmosphere. We are in partly responsible for what is happening in Boulder and elsewhere. And while these two gentlemen, these experts, are on the phone, I'd love to hear. My understanding is that the jet stream up north is meandering and slowing down as the differential between the temperature at the poles and the temperatures below the jet stream become less intense. And so with that slowing down, I mean, we're having this chilly spring in Madison, and last year we had this extreme heat in the spring. And I'd like it if you could help people understand why the weather is getting stuck in places longer, why these storms are dumping for longer periods, in part by how that jet stream is moving.
Carl, thank you. Matt Kelsch, would you respond, please?
Yeah, so what you're referring to is typically storm systems move from west to east across the country carried by the jet stream. But the jet stream isn't just a straight west to east flow of air in the upper atmosphere. It can meander, and sometimes those meanders can really buckle. You get this area that just goes straight north or a part of it that goes straight south. These are known as blocking patterns, and what could happen is then storm systems slow down and stay in the same area. This kind of a pattern was responsible for what we saw here, those other floods we talked about, Hurricane Sandy last fall. But it's an active area of discussion and research in meteorology whether or not these blocking patterns are really becoming more frequent, because they've occurred throughout the centuries, even before we were recording weather. It's possible they're becoming more frequent, and some researchers say they are. Again, it's still an active area of discussion. But it's also possible that they're occurring at about the same frequency, but now when it happens, we do have more moisture, more atmospheric energy available for these storms that get stuck into the same place.
Martin Herling, would you respond to Carl's question about the slowing of the jet streams?
Yeah, that's a great question. What Carl is addressing here is the fact that Arctic sea ice has been significantly depleted in the last 15-year period or so, and that depletion leads to what's called Arctic amplification in the pattern of warming temperatures across the globe at the surface of the Earth. So at the surface, the Arctic temperatures have warmed quite a bit more than they have in middle and lower latitudes, hence this amplified signal at the pole. And so the question is, does that affect the jet stream? And that's a really a great and a core scientific challenge right now in our community. The evidence is not very strong one way or another at this point in time. Most of the amplification of the temperature differential that Carl mentioned is at the surface and is not evident when you go above the surface an appreciable distance. And that's where you begin engaging the jet stream and its intensity. So at this point in time, it's not likely that there's a strong effect of the sea ice depletion on weather patterns in the middle latitudes. But Having said that, how much of an effect, even if it's a small amount, is something we need to understand, and our research is just beginning to address this question. Back to the point about the weather patterns themselves, when we have slow-moving weather systems, almost invariably there will be extreme events. That's just the nature of how we get extreme events often. And these periods in which we have more blocking or less blocking have come and gone over the last 100 years. The data indicate that there are active periods and inactive periods. It's virtually impossible to see within the record of the last 100 years that the latest period is unusual in any particular way.
Hmm. Here's another caller from Madison, Wisconsin. Karen is on the line. Welcome to you, Karen. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I wanted to tie together several of the things that have been discussed. I think most people would agree that the wildfires, the droughts, and the heavy catastrophic rainfalls can be traced back in part to human-caused climate change. But there's also another aspect, the development patterns and our current climate change. Both are the fingerprints of our failure to price carbon. It's not a free good to dump your carbon into the air. We quit dumping our crap into the rivers a couple decades ago, and we need to figure out to do the same thing. And I'm in line with your previous caller who talked about a carbon fee, which should go on to include a rebate to families and border adjustments so that we don't put the U.S. at a disadvantage. My question to your climate scientists is, as we fiddle around and do nothing politically, the window to act seems to be getting smaller and smaller. How much time do we have before any measures we take are hopeless?
Karen, thank you. Matt Kelsch, you first.
That's a tough question of how much time we have. I really would like to think if we're going to act, we really need to act now. And one of the things I think is really important in society in general is that if we're going to react to climate change, even when we're figuring out the details of exactly what the influences are, those actions have to be taken now, especially with respect to things like flood mitigation and water resources. As we plan for the future, we have to plan for a non-stationary climate. Because even if we were to drastically reduce our carbon now, which there's not a lot of evidence we're about to do that drastically, there's enough in the atmosphere that the climate will continue to drift toward a warmer world, at least for a little while. And we should be trying to understand, and we are trying to understand, how that's going to affect temperature and precipitation patterns. And we have to plan for that, not just for the flooding we've been talking about, but just water availability, especially important in the West, but it's important nationwide. Where is our water going to come from in the future? So I think now is the time to act. It really is.
Martin Herling, what about this notion Karen brought up of pricing carbon, of a carbon tax?
Well, I'm not going to answer that one directly because that's not my expertise, but she does raise a really important point about thinking about what the future will look like climate-wise. And if I can address that, maybe the latter point will become a little more evident
okay.
to those that are expert on that. Climate change is different than, let's say, ozone depletion was. Ozone depletion, which was a problem for society, that we could see the ozone hole, we could see how that was impacting the planet. It was very visible. It was very immediate. And we knew there was also a remedy that was within our grasp, and I think we succeeded in many ways, and it's unfolding still. Climate change is a different animal. It's back-end loaded. And when I say it's back-end loaded, it means that the effects of burning the fossil fuels and putting more carbon into the atmosphere and other gases, the effect on climate will grow and accelerate with time and will continue for a long time after you've already put the carbon in, even if you didn't add any additional carbon to the atmosphere. So it's back-end loaded. It's something that that scientists can see, in particular with the kinds of climate models that they rely upon to look at the projections for the next 50 to 100 years. It may be difficult for the average person who's not engaged in that science to appreciate that. So there is likely to be some acceleration in the pace at which climate begins to change, especially in temperatures and maybe in extreme rainfall occurrences into the future, even if we didn't radically reduce, or even if we did substantially reduce our carbon emissions, it's back. It's a back-end loaded sensitivity of the climate system.
Let me, just for time's sake, I'm so sorry, Martin, but I am going to jump in here and put Mike on the phone. He's in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Mike, I'm glad you waited and called back. Thanks so much. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Of course.
I'm in the camp that I haven't really decided yet what's going on. I mean, you have one side that say that, you know, the carbon emissions are responsible and man basically is at the heart of it. And then the other side saying this is normal weather patterns Earth has been going through for forever. Like I said, I don't yet know what side I want to believe. I'm leaning a little bit that we don't really know yet. And every time something like the Colorado floods or something, or the hurricanes come in, we always have kind of a knee-jerk reaction about we need to tax carbon emissions and all that kind of thing. In the summer of 77, I'm working in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and around 4:30 in the afternoon, a storm comes up and dumps 12 inches of rain in 4 hours. So, you know, these kind of things have been going on for a long time. I think the biggest difference is we've got so much development now in areas that we didn't have before. So when you have some of these anomalies, it's more people are affected, so it gets more press.
Mike, thank you. Matt Kelsch, would you respond to Mike from Oklahoma City?
Yeah, so weather events, extreme weather events, are a combination of natural variability with the hand of climate change in them. Now, as far as development affecting floods, that's true. But we could look at just the rainfall part of it, not the runoff. So we sort of remove the development aspect. And what we've seen looking at data over the last 60 years is that if we look at the top 1% of intense rainfall events, those rainfall events that were the most extreme, they are increasing with time. We're getting more of these very extreme events around the country. This is nationwide, a little bit more obvious in the eastern United States than the west, but it is a nationwide phenomenon. As far as there being two sides, some saying the climate change hand is playing a role and humans are responsible, and some saying it's not, it's important to remember that one of those sides, the side that says humans are playing a role in climate change, is a much bigger side than the other one. I know the media will sometimes present them as equal, but they're not. And we deal with scientific uncertainty all the time. There's always going to be uncertainty. There is with every medical decision we ever make, but we still make those because we use the best available information and we make decisions on it. And that's how we have to see this, because climate variability with climate change increasing the odds of certain events will affect our health, will affect our well-being, and certainly will affect future generations. And so we should be making decisions about how to mitigate those problems.
Martin Herling, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I want to ask this question because we've talked a lot on this program about coasts being vulnerable. There was a lot of debate about whether to rebuild New Orleans at all. Hurricane Sandy tore up New York and New Jersey. Now it seems that no matter where you are in the United States, you're vulnerable in Vermont, Colorado. Talk about people being prepared and protecting themselves as we see more extreme events like these.
Well, I mean, we are resilient people. I mean, we are a recovering type of society. So we do recover and we do rebuild. Back to Mike's point about vulnerability and the word you used, I understand vulnerability to be a relationship between people and the environment. So there's two factors, and I think Mike really addressed one in particular, the people part. People who put themselves in coastal regions, for example, or in floodplains, in more risk positions than they were 50 or 100 years ago. Population has expanded, wealth has increased, so there's more options. And environment, well, extremes have always happened. I mean, this was the president's statement that you aired a moment ago, talks about these are events that go back to ancient times. This is something to keep in mind. We don't quite know what ancient times looked like exactly, but these events have happened before, but people weren't in harm's way. So that's part of the vulnerability. The environment part that's changing is still probably a small factor, but there are some exceptions. When Sandy made landfall, Sandy as a storm was not due to climate change so much, but that storm surge had an extra 1 foot of water because sea level has risen 1 foot in that area over the last 100 years. That extra foot of water going into the subways and other areas and homes and so forth was devastating, and that had a climate change signature to it.
Hmm. Matt Kelsch, wrap us up here. What does the forecast suggest to you about extreme weather events in years to come, in the next 10 years, the next 100 years, you know, next year? What do you see?
Well, not even so much the forecast, but just the observational trends are that extreme events, the extreme end of the spectrum of weather events, we tend to be seeing things that we have seen in the past, but the odds of extreme events seem to be going up. I say seem, but there's actually very strong statistical evidence that they are going up with time. So what we may have considered, for instance, the 100-year rainfall or the 100-year heat wave, may actually, we should expect them to occur more frequently than they have in the past. We should at least prepare for that. I also want to point out what Boulder Creek experienced, and people in Boulder might not want to hear this, was not necessarily a worst-case scenario. The canyons immediately to our north, like the Big Thompson and St. Vrain, actually had much more devastation than Boulder Creek did. So if people in Boulder want to see what a real worst-case scenario is, they just have to look north to our friends in Lyons and what they went through.
Hmm. Well, many thanks to both our guests today. From Boulder, Colorado, Matt Kelsch, hydrometeorologist at the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research. Matt, thank you very much for your perspective. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
And Martin Herling, research meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Earth System Research Lab in Boulder. Many thanks to you, Martin. Appreciate it. Coming up tomorrow, novelist Margaret Atwood is back with her end of the World Trilogy and a new human race. Tom Ashbrook is back for that tomorrow. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.